Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
As many of you who have heard me in the past know, I'm a fan of Winston Churchill, who knew something about battles. And he said, never give in. Never, 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 never. And nothing great or small, large or petty, never give in. Never yield to force. Never yield to the apparently overwhelming might of the enemy. We must fight, and we must fight to drive the predators out of this province.
That's the iconic voice of the late Rafe Mayer fighting to protect our rivers at a Maple Ridge rally. On this week's show, we talk about the legacy of Rafe Mayer with his colleague Damian Gillis from the Common Sense Canadian, so stay tuned. On October 9th, British Columbia lost one of its most iconic voices with the passing of Rafe Mayer. He was a Canadian lawyer, political commentator, radio personality, and politician who for the last decade has been working closely with Damian Gillis on environmental issues with the online Common Sense Canadian. Damian's a Vancouver-based filmmaker with a focus on environmental and social justice issues. He recently produced a film called Fractured Land, dealing with the issue of fracking in British Columbia. Welcome to the show, Damian.
Thanks, Stuart. Good to be back.
You've been working closely with Rafe in the last decade, and I remember hearing him give a powerful speech in Maple Ridge. He was in his late 70s at the time, so where did Rafe find this endless well of energy? I mean, he never stopped. He never retired.
Well, the meeting that you're talking about was regarding a proposed private power project in the Upper Pitt River, which is a place that Rafe had fly fished, and that was something that was a great love of his. He'd also fought to protect it from gravel mining once before. It had been turned into a provincial park. And then we were back at it again with a company that wanted to divert all five major tributaries and home to all five species of spawning salmon and a whole bunch of other wilderness values. So this was a place that was very near and dear to Rafe's heart. And it was kind of one of the first really big projects to come along in this program of privatizing our rivers for power that we really didn't need and carried a whole bunch of environmental consequences. And so when Rafe spoke at that event, he, in his characteristic fashion, he invoked Winston Churchill, who's his great hero, and he really rallied people to, in the words of Churchill, never, 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 never give in. And that was something I think Churchill was somebody that he drew a lot of inspiration from. And that attitude of, and that really was, when Rafe was a young man, he wasn't quite old enough to go into World War II. But I think he paid very close attention to it, and that had a really deep impact on him, as I'm sure it did on many people. But that attitude of Churchill, in the middle of the Blitzkrieg, walking down the streets of London in defiance of the Nazis, that was something, and blending both passion and extraordinary eloquence and use of the English language, those were things that I think had a really formative influence on a young Rafe, and those were some of the tools that he brought to the table through his career as a politician, later as a very powerful broadcaster. That was one of his most important role models, and that was something that he brought to these battles in BC and used that to really fire other people up and give them permission to channel their inner Churchill, their inner Rafe, and tell these companies and governments when they didn't think that something should be done. And he did that time and time again.
He certainly didn't mince words. I was reading a recent Toronto Star article honoring him, saying he was a hard-hitting interviewer who was tough but fair. And I'll quote you in your article that you posted. He was an intelligent, entertaining firebrand with a deep sense of justice. Are we ever going to see someone like Rafe again in the mainstream media in this day and age? Is there any courage left out there?
Well, I think there's courage in people, but it's the medium that has changed. And Rafe always said that it wasn't really him that changed, it was the world around him. So even when he was a Socred politician in the late 70s in a right-wing government, he still did some pretty progressive things, like preventing the raising of the Ross Dam that would have flooded our beautiful Skagit River, stopping the slaughtering of wolves in the north, bringing a uranium mining moratorium. Those are things that today would be really hard to imagine the right-wing government of the day, i.e., say the Harper government federally, or the recently 16-year reign of the Liberals. You would never imagine a government doing that sort of thing. Rafe would say that it's the right that has changed, and I think he would also say that it was the media that changed. There was a time when he was had the top radio show in Western Canada, and he had the full support of a family-owned company, the Griffiths family, in particular Frank Sr., who owned WIC Radio, and which owned CKNW, and really would back Rafe up. And if people gave him a hard time, it could have been very powerful political leaders all the way up to the prime minister or big corporate sponsors of the radio station. There were many famous battles that Rafe would recount to me with then GM of the Canucks, Brian Burke. And anytime Rafe would say anything negative about the Canucks on his show, they'd be sure to get a call from Burke whining about Rafe and demanding an apology. They spent a lot of money advertising with CKNW and had a really strong relationship with the station. But Rafe, the sales guys would come to Rafe and say, hey, can you help me fix this relationship? Can you please apologize to Brian? And Rafe would tell them where to go. And then when these ad guys would go back to the boss and complain about Rafe, that he wasn't a team player and he was being too pugnacious, Frank always had his back. And he said, if you can't sell advertising with Rafe's numbers, those being, two or three times what any of the top broadcasters in today's market have, then you're in the wrong business. And I think that was part and parcel of a media. What we've seen is an incredible consolidation and corporatization of media. It took place in radio when the Griffiths family sold to the Shaw family and their Chorus Radio behemoth, and that was the beginning of the end of Rafe's tenure there. And I think it also we see it, Rafe was very critical about Post Media, our biggest newspaper chain, and their relationship with the oil and gas industry. A $5 million agreement to provide journalism that was supportive of pipelines and tankers without telling the public that that's where it was coming from, just that they would think they were normal news stories or editorials. That gives you a sense of how the media has changed, and it really there was no place for a Rafe Mayer, that type of voice, in the mainstream corporate media anymore. And that was something that really preoccupied him. In his later years, he did a lot. He was very critical of the changes that happened in media. But there certainly is a place for those kind of voices in the burgeoning new media. It's not as well funded as the mainstream used to be. They don't have the same kind of resources that Rafe used to have at NW and other big reporters in print. But we're finding a way for these stories and these voices to get out there through social media and through online media. And that was something I think Rafe was, it was very fitting that even in his 80s, he was really a pioneer in the new wave of journalism.
That's a good bridging point, because Rafe was always authentic. I want to quote him. He says, "You make a serious mistake when you assume that those in charge know what the hell they're doing." And he recently called out Rachel Notley, telling her to go to hell when she was threatening BC, saying that we're landlocking their economy and we have no right to do that. As a common sense Canadian journalist yourself, how do you feel about that comment where Alberta is whining that we don't have a right to block their thriving economy?
Well, I completely agree with Rafe. And Rafe, I'm like Rafe, a British Columbian first and foremost, and we both shared a deep love for this province. And Rafe was always very independent. If you look back at the, he represented the province on constitutional matters in the just before he left government in the early 80s, and he was really credited with torpedoing the Charlottetown Accord on the radio. BC was the highest no vote in the entire country at 68%, despite all the predictions from Central Canada that we would go along with this constitutional change that created what Rafe viewed to be an unequal and unjust situation constitutionally in Canada. And so he always had BC's interests at heart. And we see that in recent years with this this narrative that we get all this finger wagging from people west or east of the Rockies, telling us how dare we hold our rivers and our salmon and our coast and our supernatural tourism economy, how dare we hold that up higher than the rights of Alberta to build new pipelines and to exploit their resources through tanker routes, et cetera. And, you know, the bottom line is the economics aren't there. There's no real justification, as we continue to see with bottomed-out oil prices and capital fleeing the oil sands, which has very little to do with the protests and pipelines being closed off. It's more the other way around. You know, we saw that with the LNG industry, which he's very critical of as well. And we were predicting going back 6 years at the Common Sense Canadian that there would be no industry, not so much just because of the people that First Nations and communities that opposed it and the fracking that it would require and all the carbon emissions that would come out of the process, but also because it wasn't a smart economic plan, and it's not the right direction for Canada to be going in. And if we want to be building a healthy, long-term, sustainable economy, then we're really barking up the wrong tree with this whole program. And Rafe was sensible enough to see that, and he really did not like being lectured to and held hostage, really, by other provinces like Alberta. And what Rafe expressed very powerfully and without any inhibition, what a lot of British Columbians are feeling. And I think there's an alien sense of alienation here that we've never really been understood by the rest of this country. And they continue to take for granted that we're just going to roll over. And in doing so, they really fail to understand the spirit of this fiercely independent spirit of this province. And Rafe really personified that.
You know, I'll be driving over the Second Narrows Bridge, and I look over and I see all the pipe they're amassing in the shipyards. And I just got a letter in my mailbox saying that they're going ahead with the Kinder Morgan terminal expansion, and, you know, the premier signs off on it. So a lot of people just say, look, it's going to happen. You're just wasting your breath. All the powers that be are lining their ducks in a row. How do you respond to that, that, hey, what's the point when these powerful interests are just moving ahead despite public backlash?
It's like Churchill said, like Rafe echoed, you never give in. And the bottom line is Rafe has killed massive giant projects, including most notably the Kamano completion project. Alcan was the largest, one of the largest smelting and mining companies in Canada at the time. And it's now today with Rio Tinto is one of the largest companies in the world in that sector. And he killed the Kamano completion project that would have, we know, killed fish in the Fraser River because of lowered levels of water in the Nechaco, a major tributary. And he had basically given up on it. He had finally, after years of fighting against it on his radio program, he took his wife Wendy out for dinner in Horseshoe Bay, and basically to commiserate over what he viewed to be a failed campaign. And a camera crew from Global TV came running up to them, as Rafe told as the story to me, and they wanted to get a comment from him on what he thought about Kamano being killed. And he didn't even realize, but earlier that afternoon, Premier Harcourt had pulled the plug on this project. And he used that as a story to illustrate why you never give up, because you just never know. You could be right on the verge of a breakthrough. And Rafe has won enough battles and worked on enough campaigns. And, you know, we were able to torpedo, along with the work of many other British Columbians who joined us in this, some multi-billion dollar private river power programs, all of which would have made our situation at BC Hydro much worse. The bills would have been higher for consumers. We would have had more fish killed from that. And look at the Enbridge pipeline. Many people say, I've won a number of cases of beer and money from friends who bet on that, you know, there's no way we could stop the Enbridge pipeline. A lot of people would have said that about Energy East project that was recently pulled. A lot of people would have said that about the LNG industry that has recently tanked. And so I think there's absolutely an opportunity here with Kinder Morgan. And Rafe, I'm sure, from a better place, is watching down upon all this with great interest. And his spirit will be guiding people in this battle. People like Burnaby Mayor Derek Corrigan, who is refusing to be bullied by Kinder Morgan. There are several court cases going on in both federal and provincial court. First Nations have a really strong constitutional position. And then we saw just a taste of it at Burnaby Mountain a couple of years ago with all the protesters that came out, and they had a legal win against the company. And that was just getting warmed up for what is coming down the pipeline, so to speak, if Kinder Morgan thinks that they're going to bulldoze this thing through. Vancouver's, unlike Kitimat, where the Enbridge pipeline would have been, is a city of 2 million people, so there's an an endless well of human, support here, of bodies that can put themselves in the way of the bulldozers. And they're really, this company does not have the social license. It doesn't have the economic conditions in its favor. And I would not bet that this pipeline is going to go ahead.
Now, you've touched on quite a few things. You keep bringing these private power river projects. Now, I remember when they were first proposed, a lot of people kind of were duped because they thought, okay, we're into green energy. Gordon Campbell is promoting green energy. And these projects are, they're moving us away from fossil fuels. Can you just quickly describe what you mean by these private power river projects? Because I think people get them confused with, say, the Bennett Dam or something like that.
Well, there was nothing green about them. I mean, the bottom line is you don't fight climate change by destroying fish habitat and locking and clear-cutting massive swaths of old-growth and second-growth forest on the coast to build these massive networks of roads and transmission lines through the bush. I went out there. I mean, I visited more of these sites than anybody in British Columbia, so I can speak with confidence about what I saw, what I documented with my camera. These were horror shows in the bush. The amount of violations, we had over 700, just even a few years ago, over 700 documented violations of the fish rules within the contracts of these companies. And that's with very few boots on the ground at the Ministry of Environment to even observe and monitor and enforce these projects. So we know there's been huge problems ecologically with them. The other thing we knew is that we didn't need the power. And the reason is that these run-of-river projects, they don't have big dams or reservoirs behind them. They still create a whole lot of damage regardless. But you have to take the power when it's going. And the main period of the year when that happens is during the spring with the spring melt and runoff. And that's the worst time of the year for us. Our energy demands are at their lowest. We're not using our heating much anymore, and we're not yet turning on our air conditioners. And at the same time, we're awash in power from the rest of our hydroelectric system, and our neighbors whom we trade power with are in the same sort of boat. So this is a terrible time. It's the worst time of year for this power to come online. And we are forced to take it and pay for it, and we're losing over $1 billion a year. We've got $58 billion of these contracts. And BC Hydro now that the Liberal government is gone, under oath at the BC Utilities Commission, looking into Site C, they said if we had our choice going forward, we wouldn't buy any of these private power projects because of all the reasons I just said. So if you're going to replace some sort of fossil fuels that you're already using, then that's one argument. But this isn't replacing anything. It's just putting a glut of new electricity into a market that we don't need. And in the process, it's having extraordinary ecological damage and carbon consequences when you're logging all these forests and releasing all that carbon, and you're taking away the ability of these ecosystems and watersheds to sequester carbon in the future. So that whole climate argument was absolutely ridiculous. It never held any water for us, and that's why we fought against it.
Now, you have some personal experience with your family and people who impose dams on the population. To be the devil's advocate, I've heard so many people say British Columbia is a growing province. We have more and more people, and we're going to need the future power needs. So how do you stand on projects like Site C?
We don't need it. My family, like you say, lost. It's beautiful ranch. Because the first big dam, WAC Bennett Dam, it was a different time. And we sort of understood that it was part of building a public power system for the province. The bottom line is, Stuart, the numbers just don't back it. And all the leading independent experts who've looked at this, even the joint review panel that was tasked officially with reviewing this project, questioned the long-term need for this project. The head of the commission is now retired, and he's been a very outspoken opponent. The former head of BC Hydro, Mark Eliason, has been very critical. There are a whole bunch of people who really know what they're talking about electricity say we don't need the power. Even BC Hydro, when it was going through the review process, said we wouldn't need the power till 2029 at the earliest, and yet we're spending what will inevitably be well over $10 billion as the costs continue to escalate here for power that we don't need and that won't be paid off until 2094. You know, it's absolutely preposterous. The fact of the matter is, yes, our population has been increasing over the years in BC, and guess what? Our electrical demand has not. It has been absolutely flatlined for the last decade at just over 50,000 gigawatt hours a year. The reason? Because we're getting much better at conservation. As the costs of hydro go up because of the reasons that I've mentioned, and Site C would be a huge driver of costs, keep seeing those power bills going up, people get sticker shock, and they start finding out ways to turn the heat down and be more efficient. All the new construction that we're doing in the province today is a much, much higher standard for energy efficiency. And the same thing is happening across all our devices and everything like that. Plus, our industrial economy that used to be a real important part here of our economy in BC, big pulp mills and sawmills and these sorts of things, have closed down, and they're not showing any sign of returning. We're not going to get these things back. They used to make up a huge portion, up to and over a third of our total electrical demand in the province. That has drastically fallen, and it's not coming back. So you can say this stuff and make these kind of statements is to make them out of ignorance and out of a lack of actually, it sounds good on paper to somebody who doesn't know better. I do know better, and all these other people that I mentioned know better. So when you actually get into the numbers, when you get into the facts and the figures and the statistics, that argument doesn't make any sense.
They were like kind of teasing the new premier, John Horgan, saying, how do you stand on Site C? And they feel that he won't just strike it down because all those jobs, all those construction jobs and all these, we're always kind of told we have to compromise our environment if we're going to have a healthy economy. What are your thoughts on this?
Oh, I mean, give me a break is my thought on that. We're supposed to spend, first of all, a lot of these jobs aren't even going to British Columbians. There's a maximum of 2,000 jobs we're talking about, many of them out of province right now for a short period during the construction phase, and then they're gone. Okay, and there have been all sorts of problems with these jobs. A lot of people getting laid off, a lot of people complaining about the work conditions, unsafe conditions, all sorts of problems with this project. And so what we're talking about here, because we don't need the power, we've established that, is we're talking about a $10 billion or a $15 billion public subsidy to create 2,000 jobs at the most for a 5 or 6 year period. Imagine how much jobs we could create and for how much of a more long-term sustainable situation if we were prepared to spend, if that's the only reason we're doing this. There are a lot of ways that we could spend $10 or $15 billion and create a heck of a lot more jobs for British Columbians. So if that's what we're down to, if that's the last argument, and I suspect that the real argument here, the only last fig leaf of this whole fraudulent project, is that there are some big donors to government over the years who have multi-billion dollar contracts to build this project. That's where the real juice is, in my mind, is that they want to get that money. They want to pilfer it out of the public purse for something that we don't need. They want to transfer $10 or $15 billion of wealth out of the pockets of everyday British Columbians and into their pockets. And they don't want to see that stopped, okay? And there's going to be penalties for us to pay if we cancel these contracts, but that's what needs to happen. This was never about the public benefit. It wasn't about the public benefit 30 or 40 years ago when the Utilities Commission said we don't need this project. And I don't think at this point that they're going to come out with a strong verdict like, don't do this project or do it. Ultimately, they're going to make a series of recommendations, but I think it's going to be fairly critical, and then it's going to come back on John Horgan and the NDP. That's where the rubber's going to meet the road, and it's going to be up to them whether they have the cojones or not to listen to this expert advice, a review that should have happened a long time ago by our public regulator, but the Liberals forbade it, and it's going to be up to the NDP to decide whether or not they've got the cojones to shut it down, which is what they should be doing.
How do you feel about the NDP currently on their stand on the environment? First of all, they've come out against Kinder Morgan. They haven't really said much about fish farming. So what are your thoughts? What grade will you give the NDP so far?
I'd give them like a B+, to be honest. I mean, I think it's too early. Like, we'd be talking about like a midterm grade at best here.
Okay.
A few months into this, but they've taken some big steps. You know, and they haven't necessarily always done it exactly as people would want. You know, they're bringing in a partial ban on grizzly bear trophy hunting, but there are some loopholes involved that some of my colleagues who are very, rightly concerned about that. British Columbians are 90% against that practice. And so they've left some loopholes that need to be sutured up now. You know, the position that they've taken on Kinder Morgan is maybe a little confusing to some, but they have fought it in the federal court, and we'll see what happens with that. But, they've gone a lot further than the Liberals, and they've done what they feel they're able to do in this situation. They're now reviewing this ridiculous system of professional reliance, which is basically where the fox is guarding the hen house in terms of environment, industrial projects around BC. And with the fish farm thing, they've instituted an investigation into the provincial veterinarian lab that is responsible for overseeing and testing fish farms for diseases. And I can tell you from what I know and the work that I've of Alex Morton that I've followed and other things that I'm privy to, that review is long overdue. So I'm glad that they're doing it. I understand that we're going to hear some results sometime in the new year about that. If the investigation is carried out correctly, then there's going to be some serious problems posed to the ongoing operation of the fish farm business. You know, the NDP have come out, they've made some statements here. The fish farms are flouting the new NDP government. The corporate media punditry that we talked about has been very hard on them. They're telling them, oh, you can't put in the, you can't respect the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People vis-a-vis fish farms or other things. That's put a chill on the business community. You know, the bottom line is this fish farming business has never been a good thing for our economy. Employ at best 600-700 people in British Columbia. And look at all the things that they do that they put at jeopardy, including our commercial.
A wild salmon. Yep.
Etc. All the crap, literally, that they dump every day into the ocean, polluting our marine environment. This is, it's not a benefit to the public in BC. This is a Norwegian-owned industry that sucks the profits out of this country, and they have some low wage jobs that they, you know, a few hundred that they provide to local communities on the coast. So I've never bought into their argument, and with the way that the business-oriented mainstream media is handling this, going after and attacking the NDP, they're missing the point. This industry has been very badly regulated. We have disease issues here that we're not getting to the bottom of, that's affecting very likely the larger marine environment and much bigger values for British Columbians. And it's about time somebody took a good look at it. And then we're just going to have to wait and see a little bit here and give the NDP, I think, a little bit of latitude as they bring these policies in. But I'm pretty encouraged by the start that they've made, and I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, at least for a little longer.
All right. Thank you so much, Damon. We have about a minute left. Tell people how they can have access to your online journal, which is quite excellent and up to date on the issues. And also, how would you feel that Rafe Mayer would like to be remembered?
Wow. Well, that's hard to do in a minute. I think Rafe would like to be remembered as a British Columbian who was a people's champion and a champion of the environment. I think that's basically, and somebody who was never afraid to stand up to powerful interests on behalf of the little guy. And I think that's exactly what he did throughout his career. You can see, speaking of our website, commonsensecanadian.ca, that's commonsensecanadian.ca. The lead story that's on there right now is my memoir, Reflections, on 10 years of working with this great man, this BC icon. So, and there's lots of little clips of video and of Rafe on the hustings doing battle with these powerful forces over the years. So I encourage your listeners to go check that out. And I'm not sure when this is airing, but Rafe's memorial is happening Monday, October 30th at Christ Church Cathedral, downtown Vancouver, 11 a.m., and it's open to the public. So if anybody out there is a big fan of Rafe, we encourage you to come out and show your respects for this great British Columbian.
Well, thank you so much for spending some moments with me, Damien, and thank you, Rafe Mayer. We, as a fellow British Columbian, I have so much gratitude for your life and your commitment. And thank you, Damien, for lending yourself for a few moments to talk about this.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.